flag theory is a diversification strategy to protect your money, increase your privacy, pay fewer or zero taxes, and retain as much of your freedom as you can. It's kind of like giving your government a report card on what it's doing well, what it's not doing well, and then using other governments, other entities, to get what you want in a legal way, and goes from there.
Welcome to the Nomad Podcast, where we discuss inspiring stories of lifestyle transition and how to thrive in a location-independent existence. Nomad Podcast is supported in part by Nomad Prep, an online academy to help aspiring digital nomads make a successful transition. And now here's your host, Sean Tierney.
Chris Bakke literally wrote the book on how to become a digital nomad. After over a decade living abroad and consulting with aspiring nomads, he has amassed a wealth of experience in helping other people transition to this lifestyle. In this interview, Chris and I discuss how he got his start on the road, what flag theory is, the most common pitfalls facing aspiring nomads, tips for finding community while traveling, highlights from his book, and more. But before we get there, please enjoy a quick word with our sponsor. It's important to have travel insurance as a nomad because stuff happens while we're on the road. And while we hope for the best, we need to always plan for the worst. If you're investigating insurance options, check out Safety Wing. Safety Wing is travel medical insurance specifically designed for nomads. Unlike other providers, you can buy it when you're already on the road and you don't need to continuously update them on when and where you're going next. You just have one monthly subscription that covers you wherever you go for both travel and medical. And if you shop around, you'll find it's about a third of the price of other providers. Visit nomadpodcast.com/safetywing to get a quote today. And now here's the interview. All right, hey everybody, welcome to the podcast. My name is Sean Tierney. I am your host, and I am here today virtually with Chris Bakke. Chris has been living abroad now since 2008, where he met his wife, and they have been nomadic since 2013, having gotten their start in the expat lifestyle where Chris was teaching English in South Korea. Chris has since traveled to 39 countries. He recently sold his travel blog, One Weird Globe, and now designs board games under the name Entro Games, and has a new travel blog entitled Worthy Go. Chris is author of the book Becoming a Digital Nomad, which is now in its third edition. Welcome, Chris, to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Sean.
Awesome. So, Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started? So you've been abroad for quite a while now. How did this journey begin for you?
Sure. So I need to rewind the clock back to 2004, actually. This is kind of where the story starts. I've graduated college and I'm living in Lexington, Kentucky, kind of the big city near where I went to school. And I have to say, the job prospects don't look particularly good or particularly interesting. I was an accountant with the Kentucky state government for a few months. I sold mattresses for a little while. I delivered newspapers. Finally got a job teaching computer classes at the local library. And these started with, ladies and gentlemen, welcome, my name is Chris. This is a keyboard. And I'm holding up a keyboard to the class. This is a mouse. And again, I'm doing this with adults here. So I never really found a job that seemed to fit my interests or whatever. So this is now three and a half years after I graduated college. And is this really what life's supposed to be? Like just eking out some basic wages to make a life? And yeah, so December 2007-ish, I learn about people teaching English in South Korea. And my first thought was, can I do that? Is that possible? You know, at the time, you needed a bachelor's degree in any discipline. You needed some teaching experience of some kind. And you needed to be really, you needed to like kids, be good with kids. And once that's done, you know, just kind of be willing to go through the process and spend a year in South Korea. So I felt like, okay, let's check this out. So I sent in my application and resume. And the next day I got a call from the recruiter who asked some more questions. We did a little interview. And finally he said, okay, I think I can get you a job. Hold on. And so a few days later, we had a formal phone interview with the principal of a school. And everything from there was just a matter of getting the visas in place and the usual stuff like selling your car and getting a passport ready and all that other stuff. So I left the U.S. for South Korea in March 2008, and it's been kind of a whirlwind ride since then. Before I left, I started a blog on Blogspot, which is now Blogger, I think. And blogs at the time weren't these like over elaborate things. They were more like journals for friends. So I told the people that knew I was going was like, oh, you've got to send me pictures. You got to tell me the stories. What's it like over there? It's so amazing that you're doing that. And okay, sure. So one friend became five friends and five friends became 10 friends. And eventually I just said, look, guys, I can't email all of you individually. I'm going to start a blog. Read it if you want. Don't read it if you don't want. It'll be there for anyone to read at any time. So I had started this blog as a way of kind of documenting the adventure. And so when I got to Korea, I realized I saw a lot of people going to the same few bars, the same few places, and I didn't want that for me. I wanted to do something different. So from the very beginning, I said to myself, I want to go to at least one new place every single week. And this might be a new place in a city. This might be a new city altogether or what have you, but somewhere new every week. And that gave me plenty of content to work with and has been a big interest ever since.
Yeah. So what's interesting is you did this, but then I kind of think of it like, you know, blazing a trail through the wooded part and then turning around and laying a road so other people can do the same thing, which is,
yeah,
interestingly enough, exactly what I did with my course. So my question would be, what possessed you to write this book and why do you want to help other people do what you did?
Okay. So the book is called Becoming a Digital Nomad. It is a 7-step process to go through it's a great big checklist, if you want to think about it that way. It's a way of making sure everything gets done as best as possible, and it really talks you through every element of probably the biggest transition of your life. So I wrote this book because I didn't know of another book that talked about this transition, and it is a scary transition for some folks. It can look like you're giving up your home, you're giving up your car, you're giving up everything you own for what? To sit in a beach chair in Bali and, you know, sip some mojitos and work on a laptop. It feels really scary to do anything that big, especially in what might feel like a very short period of time. You might go from your ordinary life to a digital nomad in a matter of a few months. Maybe even over the year you're transitioning towards it, but most of the time the transition itself happens fairly quick. And big, quick transitions are probably the scariest ones of all. So with that market, with those people in mind, I wanted to create the guide I wish I had when I first became a nomad. I wish I knew what to expect. And in the book, I go on a bit more about the physical things you're thinking, like in terms of what you do with your stuff. I talk about the emotional aspects. How do you handle being away from the familiar? I get into some of the psychological aspects as well. And one part of it really comes back to just a rule, which is just to be proactive. This is a founding statement of the journey. You know, as a nomad, you are in control of every aspect of your journey. You know, there's no one telling you, oh, you should go here or you should stay here for this length of time. You know, most of the time, like in terms of tourist visa, the government will say, yeah, you can be there for 90 days. But there's usually a way of staying for longer if you want to deal with the bureaucratic red tape or work out another type of visa. There's ways to do that, and it starts with what you want out of your journey.
Okay, so the book, you wrote the book, and this is a 247-page book. It's available on Amazon. We'll give you guys the link there at the end. So this, I reviewed it. It's pretty extensive. And as you know, that I have my own course, but this is like a deeper dive into some of the topics that I cover in my online course. you use this presumably as a lead magnet for then consulting with people. I noticed on your website you have like a one-on-one consulting practice where you actually work with folks who are trying to make the transition. Like what have you seen? What is the most common issues you see with the people that you work with?
Sure. So I don't mind the term lead magnet, but basically I want the book to be a $10 standalone thing. It's good for most people in most situations and most lifestyles. It's meant to be used by virtually anyone. That said, the ability to put all the answers to every single person is impossible. So the consultations are really there as a way to give even more personalized advice to someone looking for the specific advice to their specific setup, their unique needs, whatever. It's more of a buy the book, read the book. If you still have questions, let's talk. And some people, I've actually had some people message me through the site and they've said, we bought the book half expecting it to just be a lead magnet, that we'd still have lots of questions. We're writing to let you know that we're thankful that's not what you did. You answered all our questions. We will probably still consult you at some point in the future, but we don't feel the need to. So in terms of setting you up for success, everything you need is in the book. And if you want a little bit more help or a little bit more personalized help, then the consultations are there as well. So the most common things that come up with consultations tends to be the feeling that I'm leaving my family, I'm leaving my friends. It becomes more a fear of the unknown. How do I do this? How do I react to this? And part of that advice comes back to, this is your journey. This is your opportunity to proactively live your life your way. So my job is not to tell you what to do. My job is to help you feel comfortable in telling yourself what to do. And when people realize how empowering the lifestyle can be, you are in control of where you go, how long you stay, how much stuff you bring with you. That's all on you. That's all your choice. And it goes eventually from somewhat terrifying to incredibly freeing. And that's a mindset change that does take some time to get to.
So without, you know, giving away any of the secret sauce, you know, obviously we want people to pick up the book, but can you just step someone through that decision tree of what, you know, what types of questions should they be asking themselves? I notice in the book, you know, you say, what's your goal of travel and what's your why? And these types of questions, but like, how do you approach, like when you work with someone, how do you approach it? And what are the kind of the initial questions that you work with them on?
Sure. So, oh man, secret sauce. I love that term. So, one of the first things I'm asking them is like, how did you hear about it? Everyone, like by the time you've gotten to me, you've heard about the digital nomad lifestyle. You've made it sounds interesting or appealing. It does not sound like the sort of thing that you can just leave tomorrow, quit your job, and jump on a plane to Thailand. You know, it's a little bit more complicated than that. So you're still in this stage where you don't quite know what you don't know. And my job is to help you understand, kind of get you from don't know what you don't know to know as much as you can to make an informed decision. And one of my goals for a first session with someone is really to get to that informed decision. And with some folks, it's not my job to tell you you can't do it. It's not my job to tell you you shouldn't do it. But sometimes a person will not be ready. And over the course of a session, they will learn that maybe this lifestyle isn't for them. And if that's the case, I tell them, well, you've spent $60 on a session here. You've saved a bunch of time. You've saved a plane ticket only to get to the country and then realize you hate this lifestyle and now you have to come back and try to restart your life however you were living before. So really it starts with, is this the right lifestyle for you? Is this what parts of it feel scary? What parts of it feel interesting? Where do you want your life to be? How do you want to live your life? What do I feel is missing in my life? What would I change about my life? And I really encourage people to be as narcissistic here as they want to be, because this is about you. This is about your journey. And whether that's for enlightenment or education or just to get a bunch of stamps in a passport, it's your journey. Let's make it happen.
And would you say, like, of the people that come to you, what percentage end up actually pulling the trigger and doing, you know, making the transition and becoming nomadic?
The vast majority of them, 75-80%.
Okay. Wow. I mean, that's, if anything, that's a testament to your book. If you've given some really valuable information, like, I see a far less percentage of that in terms of the people that go through my course and the ones that ultimately finish and do it.
Yeah. Now, I should also mention that part of my job is not to tell someone they shouldn't do it, but my hope is that as we're discussing things, they'll realize they're not quite ready. So they might take 6 months to save up some more money, or they need a longer transition period than others might. So this is not me telling them, no, you should not be a nomad. This is me asking them the questions that make them think, and they themselves come to that decision. I've had at least one person that we had a couple of sessions. They sounded like they were really interested in it, but they had some other things in their life they had to deal with first. And I told them, well, you know, take 6 months, figure out what you really want out of life, figure out what's working or not working for you. And if you want to talk again, my door is always open. You know, the notion here is not, it's not a one and done thing. This is a relationship we're building that can be as long or as short as you want it to be. I'm somewhere between guy at the bar and professional. I don't have like a professional psychiatrist title to my name, but I do speak from experience. And I hope that when people finish a session with me, they're able to use my experience to help them create a better life for themselves.
Nice. I noticed in the kind of the preparatory section of the book, you've got a question where you ask, what's your why? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you're referring by chance to, is that in reference to Simon Sinek and the Start With Why, or is that just more generically, what's your why?
It's more generic. I don't think I've read Simon Sinek's book, but everyone has a reason for what they do. And it's very easy to forget what that reason is. In my psychology 101 class, the professor talked about everything that we do comes back to seeking pleasure or avoiding pain. So on some basic level, everything we do comes back to seeking pleasure or avoiding pain. And a lot of times it's very easy to get stuck in a routine because that's what is least painful, or it is, it does give us some pleasure. So we go to work because we need money. And if we don't go to work, we might have more pleasure in the short term, but then the bank account goes dry and we're in some pain. So seek pleasure, avoid pain, that sort of dichotomy. Really understanding the why is important to understanding the rest of the story. If you're doing this to travel and see some cool places, amazing. If you want to settle into a different sort of lifestyle, you want to get up at noon and go to bed at 4 a.m., okay, that's fine. You may not need to be a nomad to do that. You might just need a different job. So that's part of the questioning that kind of comes into play. Is there something about this, the digital nomad lifestyle specifically, that that interests you?
Mm-hmm. So what would you say your why is with writing this book? What was your goal?
My why was, to make money on one level, of course. But at some level, again, going back to my need to write this book, is I want to show my expertise. I want to use my expertise to help other people. And on some level, at the time I wrote the first edition, this would have been mid to late 2017, which came out in early 2018, I did not know of another book like it. And so my thought was that you've got all these people trying to become a nomad, but there's no guide, there's no tool that really tells you how to do it. So my why was to put out good information from someone that wasn't trying to sell you a $5,000 course or create a system by which you're living the digital nomad lifestyle in their way. You know, goal of the book is to get you living the nomad lifestyle your way.
Yeah, no, and I definitely appreciate that you didn't, impose one particular approach here. You kind of more play the role of just asking the right questions to get people to think about, you know, what they need to consider to be able to do this, which is a, hats off to you for doing it that way. So I want to shift gears a little bit. You had a travel blog. Like, what? Tell me about what happened with this. How did you sell it? How did that come about? You know, it's a pretty crowded space. There's a lot of travel blogs out there. So what? How did that play out?
Sure. So to go back to Korea in 2008, when I started traveling around the country and making it a point to go somewhere new every week, I also made it a point to write about it. And about 6 months after arriving in Korea, I installed a hit counter on Blogger, because that was a thing people did before Google Analytics came along. And I had like 5,000 people coming to this site every month. And my first thought was, whoa, I was just writing this for friends and family. Who are these people? And I learned later on that quite a few people from Korea, other expats, other teachers that were in Korea, they looked to it as a site to learn more about travel and stuff like that. So that was definitely a lot of affirmation that I was doing something that people were interested in. So I kept doing it. Over time, I connected and networked with other bloggers, other travel bloggers in Korea. And at one point, the blog was at about 50,000 hits a month. So 2013, I leave Korea. I've gotten married, and my wife and I have moved to Thailand. And I realized I can't keep writing a blog about Thailand on a site called Chris South Korea. So I started a new site, chrisinthailand.com. Same original naming scheme there. And after some more trips around Southeast Asia, I realized I shouldn't write a blog post about Laos on a thing called Chris in Thailand. So I rebranded to One Weird Globe. And the focus also changed a little bit. I wanted to focus on the weird, the offbeat, the unusual, the bizarre, the sort of places that tourists may not hear about or may not know much about. And that was my focus from about 2014 to when I sold it in 2019. After a decade plus, I was getting a bit burnt out. I wasn't really putting in as much time into that project as I should have. And I was also getting really busy working with game stuff as well. So a person I know who has asked to remain nameless mentioned that they were buying blogs, and I told him about my blog and said I could be persuaded to sell if the price was right. He took a good look at the statistics and the content and came back with an offer. We negotiated a little bit more. And we eventually came to an offer we could both live with. And once the payments were made, we began the process of getting everything transitioned over. So if you're looking at One Weird Globe today, the site's going to look very different from what it used to look like. I can't say I'm really thrilled with a lot of the changes, but it is someone else's property right now, and I don't have the right to tell them how to run their website. So one thing that came up pretty early in that process was my books. I've written a couple dozen travel guidebooks and itineraries. And because the books were not part of the sale, it was just the blog and the website that was for sale. Because the books were not part of the sale, I needed to rebrand those books to something else fairly quickly, so as to avoid any confusion with directions and whatever. So in time, I chose the name Worthy Go because it kind of reflected a change in what my wife and I were interested in seeing when we traveled. We were seeing some places were very mainstream and very good. They're definitely worth seeing. They're definitely a thing that should be enjoyed. And we also saw that just because a place was offbeat did not make it a better place to see. Sometimes they're offbeat and they're unknown and for a reason. So the focus changed from being about weird stuff to being about worthy stuff. I still have a soft place in my heart for the unusual, the bizarre, the offbeat. And it's also kind of been tempered by looking for what is genuinely good out there in the world. Just because a place has 10,000 TripAdvisor reviews does not make it a good place or an interesting place. It just means it's a popular place. And there's a world of difference between popular and good. So,
sure. I'm in Canggu, Bali right now, and it's maybe epitomizes that idea. Like, you can get a ton of reviews and turn it into like a nomad hotspot, but that doesn't necessarily speak to, you know.
Exactly.
It's an echo chamber of sorts. I had another guest. So a question for you. So I had another guest, the founder of Nomad Summit, Johnny FD. I think he was guest 16. And he wrote a book, but the way he got started was by doing a blog first, and then he eventually converted his blog into a book. Was that kind of your process, or was the blog independent of the book altogether?
Okay, so what's on the blog is mainly destinations of places we've been around the world. The book content for both the guidebooks and itineraries and Becoming the Digital Nomad are all different. So Becoming a Digital Nomad has one goal, which is to help you become a nomad. The other guidebooks and itineraries, the goals here are a little bit different. The itineraries, what's happening with the itineraries, they're either 3 or 7 day guides. It's like having a virtual guided tour. So instead of just telling you, here's a lot of places in a city, good luck, I say, go to this place first, then jump on bus 145, go 5 stops, get off when you see the big white thing, you know, then go to this place. And then when you're done there, get on the subway, get on line 2 of the subway, go 4 stops, get off at this place, take this exit up to the street level, and then go to the next place, and so on. So step-by-step directions from one place to another to get to the best a city has to offer. So each book has a slightly different purpose, but none of it is just repeating blog content.
Gotcha. But did that help give you an audience, though, such that when you unveiled the book, you now had some people to sell to, or was it just completely unrelated?
I wouldn't say they're completely unrelated, but writing the books has only partially been about marketing to current readers. I'm hoping that the books find an audience of their own beyond blog readers, and I'm hoping that one builds the other. I'm hoping that if someone discovers the blog, they like the style, they like the advice, then they'll find the books helpful. At the same time, if someone has written or has discovered the books and they like the tone there, then they'll tune back into the blog to see what's happening there. So I do hope one builds each. I do hope each one builds the other.
Cool. So something you talk about in the book, flag theory, this has come up a number of times. For the people who are not familiar with that term, can you just speak a little bit about what that is? And I want to take a second to briefly pause here and tell you about an exciting project that I'm working on. I recently left my job of 5 years to go full-time on a side project that I started called Charity Makeover. This is a hackathon that brings volunteer knowledge workers together to build game-changing digital assets for local charities in a single day. Think of it like a Habitat for Humanity, only with virtual assets instead of physical houses. I recently deployed a platform that enables anyone to bring this movement to his or her city. If you think you might be interested in being the admin for your city, visit charitymakeover.org/podcast to learn more. And now back to the interview.
Sure. So flag theory is this term. It dates back to 1964, I think, and it's basically coined by a guy named Harry D. Schultz. He was a novelist and investment pundit. And flag theory is a diversification strategy to protect your money, increase your privacy, pay fewer or zero taxes, and retain as much of your freedom as you can. So you look basically, it's kind of like giving your government a report card on what it's doing well, what it's not doing well, and then using other governments, other entities to get what you want in a legal way, and goes from there. So, for example, you might look at, if you have an LLC set up in the U.S., you might ask, how much am I paying in taxes there? How much am I paying in account fees or management fees? Am I getting the best service? The other phrase that's commonly thrown out is to go where you're treated best, or to stay where you're treated best. So it's the same mindset of proactivity. You're looking at what is available, what is on offer, and we're not just allowing inertia to tell us or dictate to us where we keep our money or what passport we have. You might be under the impression that my passport is only available from your home country, the place where you grew up or whatever. And I'm here to tell you that if you have a significant amount of money and you want a passport from another country, you can get one. And this is part of what flag theory can get into. You might have a passport from a country that lets you travel even better or even easier than you currently can. You might need a passport or a residency in a certain country to open a bank account there. But once you have the bank account, the fees are lower, it's easier service, it's friendlier service, things like that. So just in a sentence, flag theory is looking at governments as how they serve you.
Right.
And
I mean, we're all familiar with diversification, I think, in the financial sense. You know, it's like wise to not have all your eggs in one asset class. It seems to me that flag theory is basically taking that concept to a geopolitical level and not putting all your eggs in, so to speak, in that one basket, which is very interesting. It was a new term. I'd never heard it before, but it makes complete sense. And I'm actually doing that myself with I have residency in Portugal, and that's the intent, is that I'll stay there long enough to eventually get the passport.
So, just to bring it even more home, you might have a passport from one country. You might be a resident in another country. You might have a bank account in a third country, and you might incorporate your business or have the legal framework for your business in a fourth country. You know, you're making each of these choices based on how your taxes are handled, how your money's treated, if you get a better interest rate, what the tax rates are, what kind of red tape there is, and so on. So this is the sort of thing that if you're listening to this and you haven't yet made the transition to become a digital nomad, this is way down the road for you. This is over the horizon. This is just a thing to think about way down the road. For now, knowing that you have the ability to go where you're treated better, you don't have to stick with your home country's bank account, and that you do have many other options that are available. The exact options are going to be based on your goals, your country, or your nationality, how much money you have. And this is the sort of thing where consulting with people that do this for a living is going to be helpful for you.
Yeah, and for sure.
And that's not me, by the way. I'm not plugging myself for that one.
Yeah, no, there's other sites out there. We'll link to the one, the main one. It's just like, put yourself in the shoes of someone living in, let's say, Argentina or Venezuela, and imagine had you diversified and not had all your money in the local currency, I think you would be a lot happier. So this is just another strategy of how to make yourself more resilient, more immune to issues, and like you said, optimize and get the best utilization of your resources.
Exactly.
Cool. All right. Well, let's shift gears yet again. So you have lived on the road married. So can you talk just a little bit about what that's like, you know, traveling with your significant other and your wife? You know, is that challenging? How have you guys made that work?
Sure. So traveling with your partner is fucking amazing. It opens so many doors and allows you to delegate some different stuff. From the very first dates we had before we got married, travel was a really big part of our interests and a part of our lives. So, it was really important that I find someone that also liked to travel. And since then, yeah, it has been like nonstop flowers and rainbows, but we have our fights like any couple does. But traveling with your partner makes some things easier, and it makes some things a little bit more challenging. If I was by myself, then needing to choose where to go next is just, okay, I feel like going here, you know. So when you're married or traveling with a partner, you must consider their interests, their needs as highly as yours, if not higher. In some cases, this comes down to, well, we both want to go to country X, but because we have different interests, we'll go to different places. A great example of that, we're in Warsaw, Poland, as we're recording this, and there's a lot of Nazi stuff, a lot of concentration camps, a lot of fairly depressing history I'm not personally all that interested in. So last weekend, she decided she wanted to go to one, and that became sort of an Operation Separate Ways sort of day. So instead of traveling to the same place, she'll go her way, I'll go my way, and we can come back for dinner and talk about what we saw. In other cases, it's just easier to have a person that's in your life that you know and love and trust to do anything from like watch your luggage at the airport while you go to the bathroom to just buying and looking at stuff. So looking at Airbnbs, we can both put our own set of eyes on it. We can both see if a place would be a good fit. And one of us might catch something the other person missed. So it comes down to making it a little bit easier to create the life we want. And
yeah. And I noticed in the book, you talked about like the importance of allowing space and like, you know, getting places sometimes where it gives you your own personal space, or like you said, branching off and doing two separate activities in the day, not constantly spending all your time together. I think that's a pretty good tip for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you're thinking about living spaces, obviously husband and wife or partners, you're living with them. But you still want your own space. You don't want to be physically next to them all the time. So one thing we learned pretty quick was that we needed to have at least one, and ideally more, sets of doors that we could close. So I'm recording this podcast in Warsaw again, and we're in an Airbnb with two bedrooms. So my wife is in the living room because there's more natural light there, and she loves the natural light. And I'm in one of the bedrooms, which has a nice door I can close, and I can record in relative peace, so she doesn't have to listen to everything I say.
Yeah.
So allowing for some space, allowing for some privacy, I can watch a movie on my computer without disturbing her. She can watch Whose Line Is It Anyway on her computer without disturbing me. And when it's time to come together, we can meet each other in the middle and, you know, put the clothes on and get ready to go wherever we're going.
Cool. Yeah, no, it just seems like a crucible. Like if you make it work, it's probably a really fantastic way to build a relationship. I just know from experience that on the road, the highs are super high, the lows are super low. But if you experience that with someone else, I'm sure that it's just, you couldn't be closer. So very cool.
Oh yeah. And a lot of times, I should also mention, if you're traveling, if you start the nomadic lifestyle single and you're hoping to meet someone along the way, that's an awesome and amazing goal, and I wish you the best of luck with it. It is harder to date as a nomad than it is probably anywhere else, any other type of dating in the world. Part of that is because you're moving around a lot and you need to create that connect with someone pretty quickly. My free piece of advice here is to, again, make your lifestyle work for you. If you find yourself ready to partner with someone, if you're ready to get married, you know, don't feel like you have to rush this. Don't rush this period. If the timing of it doesn't quite work, then maybe that's fate. Maybe that's a sign that you need to chase them a little bit. And they want to be chased, of course. you know, I have heard some success stories of nomads that met in the same hostel and then they traveled for a few weeks and then they decided to change their plans and travel together. And whether their union is done or created by a church or a proper wedding or whatever, is not as important as you might think. We are married as husband and wife because when we were getting started leaving Korea, we were hearing from how in some countries, some hospitals will, like, if you're in an emergency room, they'll only let the husband or the wife or the spouse in. They may not recognize a common law partnership or just life partner. That's a really backwards view of things, but you don't want to be denied the ability to do that. There may be some tax benefits if you're, quote, married versus just, you know, not traveling together. But, you know, consider that for yourself. Consider whether marriage is the best answer for the two of you. And again, you know, you're traveling, making your life your way. This all comes back to the same mindset. You know, you're making your life the way you want it to be. And for a lot of people, it's going to be better with someone in it, sharing it with you.
I want to ask you, so you're in Warsaw, Poland right now, but I noticed from your submission there, your guest submission, you've been all over. You got Serbia, Slovakia, Macedonia, Turkey, Ukraine, a lot of Eastern Europe. What is it about Eastern Europe that appeals to you so much?
Sure. So I could probably write a book on this or give a TED talk. The simple answer is that Europe has a ton of history, a ton of culture, a ton of things to see. Eastern Europe is a little bit comparatively less explored from Western Europe. But there are two other main reasons for this. One, in Western Europe, you have what's called the Schengen Zone. The Schengen Zone is the area, the region of Western European countries that has no internal border controls from one to the next. So when you go from France into Germany, you're not stopped at the border and check your passport and getting it stamped in and stamped out. There is still a border, but there's no border control. So you get 90 days if you have an American or Canadian passport or other first world passports. You get 90 days in the country or in the region, and then you have to leave for 90 days. For Europeans, this is amazing. Just having fewer borders makes it easier to travel and get around. For everyone else, it means you can stay, but only for 3 months. Then you have to leave for at least 3 months. This makes life a little bit more challenging to be a nomad in that region. So the suggestion that I sometimes tell people is look at Eastern Europe. Assuming you still have a first world passport, you are getting into each country for their own visa requirements. So most countries will just give you 3 months on arrival. No paperwork, nothing to fill out. Just present your passport once you land, and you're good. I know Georgia, actually the country Georgia, not the state Georgia, gives you a year, up to a year, as a tourist visa with no paperwork required. At least a couple of people I know have said they also give you a small bottle of wine for free at the airport when you arrive, and I thought that's fucking amazing. But yeah, Eastern Europe, it's relatively easy to get around. Because you get 3 months in this country, you can then go to the next country for 3 months. You can string them along to be in the region for as long as you want. And if you want to go back into Western Europe, you can kind of ping pong back and forth from Western Europe to Eastern Europe. The other big thing is price. Here in Poland, it's actually a little bit more on the expensive side compared to the Bucharests and the Kievs of the world. But still, you know, alcohol's cheap, food is pretty cheap. If you're coming from, let's say, somewhere in the U.S. where you can't leave a restaurant without paying about $25 a person, you're going to be floored when we went to a burger place close to home. Better example. We went to a milk bar, which is kind of a Polish cafeteria, And I think our, I think it was about 25 zloty for each person. So about $6, you know, food, drink, everything. Yeah. So, the prices are a little bit cheaper. The standards are still pretty high. Poland has a ton of history here and yeah, a lot to see, a lot to do.
Yeah. I have not been to Poland. I did a month in Belgrade, Serbia. That was part of our remote year, our remote year experience. And, yeah, it was amazing. Super cheap, really had kind of an up and coming, you know, gritty feel to it. And, I can highly recommend it. We did not make it to Turkey. We were supposed to go there, but that was right around the time when they had the airport bombings. And so they actually ended up rerouting.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So yeah, but really, and it kind of has to come back to what you want to see, what you want to do. If you, if you've been dying to live in Paris, for example, let nothing stop you from enjoying that goal. In terms of a, in terms of a longer term mindset, right? This is our life. This is what we, this is how we do. And you know, you got to live somewhere. And every few months, we go to a new country. That's how we do.
Cool. All right. Well, Chris, I think this is probably a good time to wrap up. I do have a last little part called the breakdowns. Are you ready for the breakdown?
I'm ready for the breakdown. Breakdown, baby.
What is one book that has profoundly affected you?
Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
That's a good one. I don't disagree with that. All right. What is one person you would love to have dinner with?
Jesus Christ. Not because I'm religious, but because I'm curious to see what the man himself was like, not what history claims, not what a Bible claims.
Cool. What about, what is one tool or hack that saves you time, money, or headaches?
Google Docs. So basically everything that I wrote in terms of books was Google Docs. You've got the collaboration, you've got the download as a doc, you've got download as a PDF. Just makes writing text and working with text a lot easier.
Fair enough. Have you played with a tool called Scrivener by any chance for book writing?
I have. Scrivener is actually a really good tool for fiction writing. And part of what it does is it helps fiction writers, because you tend to write a bit differently depending on the genre and the type of book. So Scrivener is actually really good in terms of offering a lot of tools that a nonfiction writer like me hasn't really needed.
Cool. All right. What about, what is one piece of music or musical artist that speaks to you lately?
I don't really listen to a lot of music, to be honest. If I ever need to relax, I ever kind of need to zone out something, I can put on the Moonlight Sonata. That's a classic piece of, you know, classical music or whatever. But
sure, yeah.
It is a, it's a very relaxing piece.
That's the piano. The
yeah. That's pure release. Moonlight Sonata. It's a Beethoven piece. It's one of those pieces that has like three different movements. Each one of them has a very different sort of sound. Most of the time, you want to relax, you put on the first one. The second one is a bit more upbeat, and the third one, I could almost see like being remixed by a metal band.
All right. Well, we'll link that in the show notes. Clearly I need to listen to it because I got it wrong there. What about two more? What important truth do very few people agree with you on?
Being proactive, consciously choosing everything is incredibly important and remains, even a decade later, very difficult sometimes.
The difficulty of being proactive about stuff and deliberate choosing.
Well, yeah, deliberately choosing everything that you do, schedules and routines and patterns, they're not bad, but they can be anesthetizing. They're very easy traps to fall in. And before you know it, you'll go, how did I spend 2 months in this country and have barely seen anything? Or, I was supposed to get something done today, but I got distracted by this other thing. You know, things like that.
Yeah, I recently read a good one, this One Thing book by Gary Keller, and it's super all about that, like slice through everything else that you could be doing. Like, how do you determine the one thing that you should be doing? I think it's It's
a very good book as well.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Last question. If you had a time machine to go back to your 20-year-old self and give yourself any bit of advice, what would you say?
Buy Bitcoin.
Fair enough.
not even a joke. Just understand what it is, how it's going to change the world. I don't think it's changed the world yet. I think it's been a little bit misunderstood and misaligned. But you look at a thing that was once fractions of a penny that is now about $10,000 per Bitcoin. It's going to change the world. It's going to scare the crap out of some people who are in control. And it's going to be a technology that does much more than just be a currency.
Mm-hmm. Good advice. I agree with you. And I think the rough edges of Bitcoin will get worked out over time. It's kind of similar to any disruptive technology. When it first takes hold, it's maybe doesn't even have parity with the experience of the incumbent technology, but it's a completely radically different way of doing it. So I think the people who get it are overlooking the warts on it and realizing just how incredibly disruptive this is. So,
yeah. Like you look back to what the World Wide Web was before browsers came out. It was complex. It was just difficult to make a connection, difficult to find anything to do. And then the first browsers came out. The first pieces of software that let people make websites came out. So as the process of creation becomes easier, there's more to see. There's more to do. Things continue to advance, whatever. Again, we're not there yet with Bitcoin, but I do see a very bright future for it.
Yeah. For the people that are listening who are interested more in learning about that, we did have an awesome guest, Miles Anthony. I think he was around 23-24 episode. Really good conversation that goes deep into the crypto and blockchain and Bitcoin stuff. So if you want more, that would be a good one to listen to. Chris, where should I send people? Where can people get your book?
Sure. So the book is at becomingadigitalnomad.com. You can learn more about the book. You can read some of the testimonials. You can get direct links to the Amazon page, the Barnes & Noble page, Apple page, whichever platform you prefer. I also write the travel blog at worthygo.com. And we didn't actually get to talk much about the games, but I also do make board games. And if you're curious about those, they're at entrogames.com, E-N-T-R-O, games. .com. And what I usually tell people is that I do have some pictures of prototypes and like descriptions and stuff. If you find a game on there that you're curious about, send me a message through the website and I'll send you a free print and play of that game. You know, you download the file, you take it to your print shop or print it off at home, do a little bit of assembly, and you've got a game to try.
Very cool. Chris, thank you so much for your time. And yeah, we look forward. We'll send people there. And I think we said we're going to try to do some kind of discount code. I don't know what that will be exactly.
Yes.
Nomad Podcast, probably yeah. The discount code.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you read the book, whether you've read the Becoming a Digital Nomad book or not, the consulting service is a confidential one-on-one session, just talking like two people on Skype or Zoom or whatever. The goal here is to help you, is to give you advice from the voice of experience, basically. And this normally costs $60 per 1 hour session. For the listeners here, I'm going to do $20 off your first session. And I want you to use the Nomad Podcast coupon code. Cool. Nomad Podcast, one word, all lowercase.
Perfect. All right, Chris, thank you so much, man. It's been great talking to you and best of luck.
Thanks a lot, Sean.
Cheers.
If you have a substantial social media following and consider yourself a micro-influencer in the digital nomad space, I invite you to check out a program I'm in the early stages of rolling out. I call it the Advocate Program for Nomad Podcast and Nomad Prep. It's a multi-level affiliate program that enables you to monetize the social media following you've built by referring my course to your followers. You can earn commission on both students you originate directly as well as students who come in via the advocates you originate, essentially a downline. And all through simply introducing your following of aspiring nomads to a course that can help them more confidently make the leap. I'm in the process of selecting a small group of early advocates who I'll be working with closely to refine this program and make it effective. In exchange for early participation, those influencers will be grandfathered in at the highest level of commission that will ever be offered in this program. To learn more about the program and the referral numbers necessary to generate a four-figure monthly side income, visit nomadprep.com/advocates and apply today. That URL again is nomadprep.com/advocates. Help aspiring nomads make the leap and get paid for doing so.
You've been listening to the Nomad Podcast. For links to all the resources mentioned in this episode, transcripts, show notes, photos, and more, visit nomadpodcast.com. Nomad Podcast is supported in part by Nomad Prep, an online academy to help aspiring digital nomads make a successful transition. Take the first 4 days free by visiting nomadprep.com/podcast.